Today is Friday, June 7th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, D-Day commemorations as the world sees an uptick in anti-Semitism.
It is a very worrying time for Europe. They are seeing a lot of the nationalist sentiment coming out in some of the parties.
World leaders meet on Sudan's military, deadly attacks on civilians. Also ahead, a legendary New Orleans musician has died. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump and French President Emmanuel Macron attended a ceremony Thursday at the American Military Cemetery in Normandy to mark the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Some 2,500 U.S. troops were killed on June 6, 1944, the first day of the Allied invasion to liberate Nazi-occupied France. Ceremonies took place across the region as Britain, Canada, and other Allied nations paid tribute to the fallen. Among the crowd, American D-Day veterans who stormed the beaches 75 years ago and witnessed thousands of their comrades fall in battle. Many who are buried at the U.S. military cemetery above the beach. Trump talked about the might of the U.S. military and paid tribute to the fallen and the veterans, saying they'd saved not only a nation, but a civilization.
They won the survival of our civilization, and they showed us the way to love, cherish, and defend our way of life for many centuries to come.
Turning to his American counterpart, President Macron spoke pointedly of the alliance between nations underpinning victory and said that the U.S., directing it at President Trump, was never so great as when it fights for freedom of others.
What we owe to you, veterans, our freedom. On behalf of my nation, I just want to say thank you.
Joining us to talk more about the event marking D-Day, we are joined by Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, the poignant ceremonies come at a time of heightened tension and fear over the future of the transatlantic alliance, and your president, Emmanuel Macron, had a very different kind of speech than President Trump did.
He was talking about what we need to think about Normandy is the promise of Normandy. Normandy D-Day landings were pillars of post-war peace. That it was an example of what happens when so many countries come together for a common goal. And Emmanuel Macron was talking about the United States is good and it's wonderful when it's loyal to universal values that founding fathers defended. So you had two very different speeches, and in some ways one wondered whether there'd been that much communication between the two heads of state about this, because Emmanuel Macron was putting a hand out and saying, you've got to re-engage with the principles of multilateralism, and Donald Trump was talking about how powerful America is and what its soldiers can achieve when they stand firm.
Obviously, Catherine, you know, D-Day really stands for multilateralism. Some might have even thought maybe he was also sort of trying to get a message through to the American president, how that theme is important in our times now.
Absolutely. Emmanuel Macron also invited many of the other world leaders to come. We had Justin Trudeau, the Canadian president, there. This has been the first time that the Canadians have had their own ceremony on the beach where their soldiers came ashore. So that was the message that Emmanuel Macron kept trying to push all day and kept in his mind when they were organizing all these commemorations, was that if it stands together, then everyone can agree on these principles of multilateralism. It sort of came right through the whole day, really, and it was such a moving day because it started out with the French and the British remembering their veterans and then went right through the day and, in fact, ended up at the end of the day with this very large international gathering which had heads of government. Among them was Nancy Pelosi, remembering all of the nations who were there. Mm-hmm. So it was such a big event for all nations, representatives there from Poland, Norway, Australia. Australia, former Czechoslovakia are also there. All these nations are there, and that was the message.
It's interesting because it comes at a time when it would appear that nationalism really is taking hold in a lot of places.
It is a very worrying time for Europe. They are seeing a lot of the nationalist sentiment coming out in some of the parties. And it's not just, though, when it comes to politics. When Emmanuel Macron and Donald Trump had talked after the commemorations, there were some sharp words when it came to the issue of trade. Emmanuel Macron and his teams were insisting to the U.S. side that they wanted multilateral rules to be respected. They were quite clear it can't just be a free-for-all. And in particular, it was said to the Americans by French negotiators that everything's got to be put back on an even keel, that this has been a period, particularly when it came to trade negotiations, that the French feel they're being pushed around, they're being bullied by the American side, and they said that it's time now for everything to calm down and for all sides to show just a little bit more respect.
President Trump did meet with President Macron later in the day.
Before he departed, yes, the two had a very long session together, 30 minutes, where they had a tete-a-tete, and then they had several hours when the two delegations were together. President Trump and President Macron were present at that, and it was during those talks that a lot of the real nuts and bolts issues were talked about, not just trade. They're also talking about Iran. President Macron wants to use all the levers he possibly can to defuse the situation. The French side is saying very clearly that America and France have got very different views on the road ahead. When it comes to Iran, they agree that at the end of the day, the preoccupation is making sure Iran does not have nuclear weapons. Another area which they are still talking about is the Middle East. I mean, that is one of the few areas where there was agreement, particularly Syria and Iraq, where the American armed forces and the French armed forces are working very well, they say, hand in hand. They say there's a very good partnership there. And also in the Sahel in Africa, they say that the American and French forces do a lot of work together.
The one other significance about this D-Day this year for this 75th anniversary is that these are really the last remaining surviving heroes that were able to attend.
Indeed. From the American side, there were 65 veterans who came ashore on D-Day. In their 90s, they were quite chipper. There is a feeling that this will be the last one that we'll be seeing them at. And I think that made commemorations that much more special and why they were so much smaller and more targeted towards individual people. You heard a lot of talking about veterans by name, what they did. And that made the day, I think, that much more special. But we also saw a lot of young people. A couple of the ceremonies, you had young people reading poems. You really felt as though the older, the veterans had passed on the message that this has been done and it's now being passed on to two generations down. You pick up the ball now and you look after the freedoms that we secured for you.
All right, that is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Well, meanwhile, world leaders, as they gathered to remember the day the U.S. and its allies defeated Nazi forces in Europe, there's been a worrisome rise in anti-Semitic sentiment and attacks. So much so that in Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel is warning German Jews not to wear their traditional yarmulkes, a head covering. They saying that there is to this day not a single synagogue, not a single daycare center for Jewish children, and not a single school for Jewish children that doesn't need to be guarded by German policemen. Joining us to talk about this trend is Rabbi Terry Buchman, senior rabbi at the Temple Beth Am in Miami, Florida, and the author of the book Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. Thank you for being with us, Rabbi. The leader of Germany has said something like this is quite striking.
Well, I think what's happening here, again, the context is necessary. It's not just happening in Germany, as you said. What's happened worldwide is that there is a shift of power away from white males who are being left behind in this shift, and a growing coloring of the world, meaning people of color are ascendant, whether it's China, India, or the browning of America, or the browning of Europe. There is a shift. When there are these kinds of seismic shifts, in the history of the world, there's almost always a pushback to the in the other direction. All those neo-this, neo-that movements that have happened in the course of the last couple of thousand years, they're all, if you trace them, they're all about a shift in power. Those who are being left out want it to return to a time which they will call the good old days, where they were in power. These shifts don't last that long in terms of human history, but they sometimes can last 100 or 200 years. And that's what we're seeing worldwide.
Why do you think this is happening?
Well, because economics and power, primarily, and they get expressed often in sociological realities. People feel left out. They want to blame somebody. They don't want to take responsibility themselves, that the fact that they are undereducated or their skill set is no longer necessary. So it's much, much easier in the history of the world. It's called scapegoating. Much easier to blame someone else. It's the Muslims' fault. It's the Jews' fault. It's women's fault. It's, people forget in America that this country and the United States of America was founded on white male privilege. And for a long time, that held sway. That has changed. It's changing rapidly. The equality of women, which is still a work in progress, equality of African Americans, as well as immigrants of color, many of whom come into the United States with the skills that Americans themselves don't have. The shrinking of the workforce and factories, et cetera, has left a lot of people behind. And again, instead of taking personal responsibility, what do I need to do in order to keep up? Let's blame someone else. It's always easy to blame minorities, especially powerless minorities. That's why immigrants are getting so much awful treatment in America today. They are people of color, 99%, and they have zero power. And so they become an easy target for scapegoating. Those bad immigrants, those criminals, those rapists, they're stealing our jobs and raping our women, et cetera, et cetera. That's psychology 101.
Are you concerned about this possibly escalating into more horrors that we'll see in the world? Or do you think that regardless, we will not see anything as tragic again? Or are you concerned that it could happen again?
I'm concerned about the individual acts. I mean, all it takes is one hater. When I was in the 60s, there was a bumper sticker, one atomic bomb can ruin your day. So all it takes is one hater to ruin a community, many lives, to cause tragedy. So we have to be hypervigilant. I think Merkel is right. Germany, like other nations in Europe, are going to have police in front of their Jewish institutions, because Jews are people of color in terms of the haters. You know, they lump us with Muslims and African Americans and Latinos. You know, we're not considered really right to them. So we have to be concerned and we have to be vigilant. The kinds of horrors that we saw in the Holocaust, that would be more than extremely hyperbolic. When the Prime Minister of Germany is calling on police to protect Jews, mm-hmm. We're not talking about anti-Semitism. We're talking about the actions of individual anti-Semites, which are being stirred up by right-wing rhetoric. Hateful words lead to hateful speech, ultimately. And we've seen it in our own country. When the President of the United States, there are good people on both sides, one of those good people decides to drive his car into a rally and murder innocent people. That's what happened.
All right. That is Rabbi Terry Bookman, author of the book Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. D-Day aside, President Trump assails his targets back home. China's panda diplomacy comes to Moscow. A gay tour group stirs controversy in Ethiopia. And the U.S. is not satisfied with Mexican steps to curb the migrant surge. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The UN Security Council discussed the crisis in Sudan Thursday after the ruling military council used deadly force to clear the main protest site in Khartoum, which led to 100 people dead. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the use of excessive force against civilians. Joseph Seigel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy about what would that lack of unity mean for the Sudanese uprising and what could be next for the country.
The main thing it means is that symbolically there isn't a universal condemnation of the military crackdown. But I don't think it surprises too many people, because China and Russia are happy to try to endorse authoritarian governments wherever possible. They don't want to give credence to these popular uprisings. And so I don't think the fact that Russia and China are blocking this carries a lot of weight. I think what will be more important now is what happens internally to the country and what African regional bodies say and do. The African Union Peace and Security Council issued a strong condemnation of the military crackdown and has repeatedly said they expect a transition to a civilian-led government. And so I think the pressure on the military will continue regardless of what happened at the Security Council.
What are the possible scenarios for Sudan with no negotiations between the military council and the protesters?
Well, I think this is what still needs to be decided. The military has taken a decision that they think they can force their will on the people of Sudan. And Russia and other statements are just trying to give them some sort of diplomatic cover. But clearly the military junta does not have any legitimacy for the actions that they're taking. They don't have any claim on authority or legitimacy for governing in Sudan. And they know that. And therefore, you know, they want to try to hold elections in as quick a time as possible to provide some sort of fig leaf to substantiate their rule. By doing it in a short period of time, of course, it plays into the interest of those who already hold a lot of the levers of power, and that means those who are tied to the military. But I think it needs to be understood that by taking violent action against protesters, and, you know, latest reports are more than 100 people have been killed, many hundreds more have been arrested, the military now owns all of the problems that Sudan faces, you know, all of the grievances that led to the protest in the first place, you know, the 70% inflation, the stagnant economy, the high unemployment, the $55 billion in foreign debt. The military now owns those problems, and they're not going to get any better. And so as those economic pressures build up, the military is going to be hard-pressed to be able to resolve it without international support and without a civilian-led technocratic government. So they're going to be under pressure to try to forge some sort of way forward with civilian representatives as this moves forward.
Some observers detected that the military council resorted to disperse the protesters after consultations with the leaders of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. What do you make of that?
Well, many observers feel there's a direct link between those meetings and the decision to crack down on the protesters. And clearly, this shows that there is a regional influence at play in Sudan. The Saudi Arabia and UAE have provided $250 million to the military junta to try to keep them in place or try to help stabilize the situation, at least in the short term. But I think what it says is that these Gulf countries are afraid of creating a precedent where there is a popular representation and a popular will on and creating some sort of democratic governance. And I think it terrifies them. And I think they really push the military to take action. Unfortunately, it seems that they're not thinking about the longer-term consequences of this. It really holds the potential to become a very volatile and unstable situation in Sudan, which will, of course, be very harmful for the population. But in the end, it's going to be destabilizing for the region as well.
All right. The United States has released a statement condemning the recent attacks on protesters in Sudan, sending condolences to victims and families and calling for restraint. The World Health Organization says it might take a long time to get the Ebola epidemic in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo under control. The agency says the number of Ebola cases in the conflict-ridden region has passed the 2,000 mark, and more than 1,350 people have died. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from World Health Organization headquarters in Geneva.
While the number of Ebola cases has climbed to 2,025, the number of new infections has dropped to 88 in each of the past 2 weeks. This is a lot, but significantly less than the weekly average of 126 in April. The executive director of WHO's Health Emergencies Program, Michael Ryan, says people must be cautious and not read too much into it. On one hand, he says the decrease in transmission of the virus is progress. On the other hand, he says transmission is ongoing and remains high. He says the disease is not yet under control.
Well, at this point, I think the outcome is effort related. Are we prepared to make the immediate, sustained, comprehensive effort to bring this disease under control? And if we are, I believe the timelines can be much shorter than the ones stated. This is a very complex situation, and that if we keep operating at less than perfect efficiency, we may end up being around dealing with this outbreak for a very long time.
Ryan is making no predictions nor comparisons with the historic 2013 Ebola epidemic in West Africa, which lasted 2.5 years and killed more than 11,000 people. He says the 700 health workers in the eastern DRC are dedicated to combating the deadly Ebola virus. He says progress is being made in engaging with communities and overcoming their fears and mistrust. Ryan adds there has been a significant decrease in Ebola cases in Katwa, which was the epicenter of the outbreak just 6 weeks ago. But he says the virus has flared up again in the zones of Butembo and Mabalako. Ryan says people must remain cautious and vigilant and follow procedures to stop the spread of Ebola. These include frequent hand washing, not touching those infected with the virus, and not handling the bodies of those who have died from the disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, McDonald's stores all over the United States Thursday accepted any amount of foreign currency in exchange for an item on the worldwide favorites menu. The global franchise has thousands of stores across the globe with unique items on each country's menus. VOA Asia's Anna Cook made a special trip to a nearby Mickey D's.
The worldwide favorites menu included the Grand Mc Extreme Bacon Burger from Spain, Stroop Waffle McFlurry from the Netherlands, Tomato Mozzarella Chicken Sandwich from Canada, and Cheesy Bacon Fries from Australia. John Lynch, a Maryland native visiting D.C. with his friend for the weekend, found the experience a pleasant surprise.
It was certainly nice getting to experience this new out-of-the-country experience, if I have to say so. And, bacon bits, cheese on fries, it's certainly not what I was expecting to eat today, but it's very good, and I'm glad I got it.
There are more than 36,000 McDonald's stores in over 100 countries. The owner-operator of the McDonald's store in Roslyn, Virginia, Carlos Mateos, says this is an exciting promotion that allows customers to get a global experience.
This is going to be all across the country. So any McDonald's that you go into, we're selling these worldwide favorites. Oh, I'm glad that we didn't just do all four recipes from one country. We just really went all around the world and brought them here.
McDonald's stores in the U.S. will continue to rotate favorites from around the world for a limited time. Anna Cook, VOA News, Washington.
The family of the Louisiana-born musician known as Dr. John
says the celebrated singer and piano player who blended black and white musical influence with a hoodoo-infused stage persona and gravelly bayou drawl has died. He was 77 years old. In a career marked by drug addiction, he later had a top 10 hit with Right Place, Wrong Time. He collaborated with numerous top-tier rockers, won multiple Grammy Awards, and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. A family statement released by his publicist says Dr. John, who was born Mac Rabanik, died early Thursday of a heart attack. His spooky gris-gris gumbo ya-ya slithered onto the pop-dominated market in 1968, startling listeners with its sinister implications of otherworldly magic. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Promoting greater respect for human rights remains a key component of U.S. foreign policy, including in its relations with Vietnam. At a recent meeting of the U.S.-Vietnam Human Rights Dialogue, U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Scott Busby expressed concern over the increasing number of political prisoners in Vietnam, which he estimated to be over 100. Mr. Busby described his visit with one such prisoner.
While I was in Vietnam, I made a visit to one political prisoner of particular concern, namely Chun Thi Nha, who is imprisoned in the middle of the country. She received a 9-year-long sentence merely for exercising her freedom of speech. She served 2 years of that sentence already, but faces another 7 years.
Internet freedom is also under assault in Vietnam, reports Deputy Assistant Secretary Busby. Vietnam, he said, recently adopted a cybersecurity law that we have a number of concerns about. We, as the Human Rights Bureau, of course, are concerned about the restrictions this law poses on exercise of freedom of speech. Bloggers are being arrested in ever larger numbers. The U.S. raised with Vietnam the case of blogger and contributor to Radio Free Asia, Chung Zui Nhat, said Mr. Busby.
He was recently in Thailand, applied for refugee status in Thailand with UNHCR, and then mysteriously disappeared from Thailand and suddenly reappeared in a jail in Vietnam. We're very concerned about his case, about the circumstances surrounding his abduction in Thailand and his transfer to Vietnam. He has not yet been charged or prosecuted. but we're very concerned about the way the government is treating his case.
With regard to religious freedom, the Vietnamese government's record is mixed, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Busby.
We continue to have concern that unregistered religious groups in Vietnam are being harassed, are not able to freely practice their religion. That said, those groups that have been willing to register under Vietnam's religious freedom law have enjoyed a greater degree of freedom to practice their religions than they have in the past.
The U.S. continues to call on the Vietnamese government to release all prisoners of conscience and allow all Vietnamese citizens to express their political views without fear of retribution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News.